Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In his marvelous new book, Said the Prophet of God, Hadith Commentary Across a Millennium, Joel Blecker, Assistant Professor of History at George Washington University, engages with tremendous lucidity and brilliance the topic of Hadith commentaries in Muslim intellectual history across time and space. Traversing the pre-modern and modern periods in sites ranging from the Middle East to South Asia, this book presents in remarkable detail and with considerable nuance the intellectual, social, and material stakes of the discipline and performance of the Hadith commentarial tradition. This book will be of great interest to students and scholars of Muslim intellectual history, material religion, South Asian Islam, textuality and orality, and the Hadith tradition. Here now is my conversation with Professor Joel Blecker. Hello, Joel. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Very good, Joel. Thank you so much for your time. It's such a pleasure going through this incredibly nuanced book that engages and brings together intellectual and social history in such a profound and effective fashion. So look forward to this conversation. Joel, we have a tradition of New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is always biographical. Could you share a bit with our listeners how you became a scholar of Islam and then perhaps how you got to write this particular book?
Oh, sure. So I came of age in the early 2000s. I was a musician living in West Philadelphia, which, if you're familiar with it, you know it's one of the most eclectic and rapidly growing Muslim communities in the country. And it was an interesting time to live there. I think I was teaching at the Center for Literacy, and I could see that my students, whether they were from East Africa or West Africa or South Asia or the Middle East, or whether they were African Americans who grew up with Islam or converted to Islam, they all had this shared connection to Islamic history. And I remember my friends and I, we used to go up to 52nd and Market on the weekends looking for the latest bootleg or mixtape. And once we got there, we saw that all of these Islamic bookstores had set up shop selling Quran recitations on CDs, audio recordings of local imams, sermons. They were selling Hadith texts in Arabic and Urdu and in English. They would sell the wooden toothbrush, the suwak, that apparently Muhammad loved. He always loved to carry one in behind his ear. And they would sell scented oils and incense. And you could just see what a robust and complex community this, and what a complex living tradition this was. And if you recall, in the early 2000s, it was also one of the darkest periods of the so-called War on Terror. It was the age of 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. And it felt like every day we were reading about new abuses, Guantanamo Bay or Abu Ghraib. And it wasn't just in the media or the public square where we saw this a great ignorance about Islam, but also in the halls of the academy, my own college, which saw itself as a leading liberal arts college in the country, didn't offer Arabic in the curriculum, which seems unusual now, but was very normal for that time. So this dissonance, I mean, between my own local life and my local community and seeing the way in which this rich and dynamic tradition was being simplified and caricatured and lampooned in the public discourse and excluded from certain academic discourses was really related. I mean, I could really relate to it. I was one of the only Jewish kids at my school growing up in a small town in Northeast Ohio. And I felt like I could relate to what it meant to be, to feel different, to have a funny name that was tough to pronounce. but I also felt like I knew that my own tradition had been shaped by this Islamic history. Maimonides wrote in Arabic, after all. I, you know, had grown up reading a Semitic language from right to left. So it really started just as an obsession with studying Arabic in those days. And eventually that obsession drove me to move to Syria in 2006 and 2007, where I was studying Arabic at the University of Damascus. And, you know, I think I was paying the rent writing classical Arabic subtitles for Canadian music television shows and for Canadian cooking shows. And I got a little money doing part-time teaching. I was teaching English to Palestinian refugees. And I met a few scholars while I was there that really opened up my eyes to the Islamic scholarly tradition. And it seemed like each genre that we would study was just this expansive ocean that you could spend your whole life studying. Quran commentary, hadith, Islamic law, Islamic history, literature. And so I think I applied to graduate school from an internet cafe in Damascus, and the fellow sitting next to me, I think, was playing online video games or something like that, was uploading my application statement. And I was lucky to have been admitted. And to be perfectly honest, I wasn't sure I was ready to come back. I wanted to stay in Syria for as long as I could. And I can't remember which one of my advisors eventually convinced me, whether it was Qasim Zaman or Michael Cook or Sean Marmon, but they said, look, you can come back. You can come to Princeton, do your research, and in the winters and the summers, there's plenty of funding for you to go back to Damascus. And that's exactly what I did. Every winter, every summer that I could go, I went back, and that's where I discovered these live hadith commentary sessions for the first time that were attended by hundreds of students from all over the world. And I went back until I couldn't go anymore in 2011 when the turmoil began. And what was at first an uprising and a revolution that later became a civil war. And in a way, you know, as scholars and researchers, we're also shaped by these macro historical events and these wars. And in a way, not being able to go into Syria made me rethink, you know, how was I going to continue my research? And in a way, it was that time that really pushed me out of the Middle East and into India and into South Asia. And I had a grant to go back to Damascus in the summer of 2011 that I rewrote to travel to Hyderabad. And I studied with a Hadith scholar, Sheikh al-Hadith, in the old city of Hyderabad, India, where they still speak Urdu. And that was another really formative moment for me because it got me out of my Middle East-centric framework and really opened new horizons and new perspectives for me in thinking about my work and thinking about the Islamic tradition more broadly. So and those were the formative moments. My Jewish upbringing, ironically, my time living in West Philadelphia in the darkest periods of the war on terror, moving to Syria, and then traveling to India in 2011.
Joel, I was wondering if you could begin by speaking a bit about the broader concerns and argument of the book. And one of the things that I found most fascinating and really one of the strongest points of the book is the way that it combines intellectual and social history. And this is a point that you make repeatedly throughout the book, which is that you really approach this whole genre of hadith commentary in a way that looks both at the material and social rewards of this genre of writing and performance, but also the aspect of developing and cultivating a certain kind of excellence that connects scholars to the prophetic past. And it's, you really combine these two understandings of how one can approach this field in really remarkable and interesting ways. So I was wondering if you could just speak broadly, briefly about what is the larger theoretical concern that animates this project and how you bring together intellectual and social history in this project.
Sure. So I can talk about the most pertinent example or one that might really relate to your listeners. When I was in Damascus in 2009 and I discovered these live hadith commentary sessions, a commentator commenting on one of the most important hadith collections for Sunnis, Sahih al-Bukhari. He had been commenting on it line by line for 7 years at this mosque, which sat in the shadow of the Ba'ath Party headquarters in Damascus. And everybody widely assumed that it had been under state surveillance. And you could always hear these coded political messages and political polemics in some of his commentaries. And it would be easy for us as social and political historians to look at an event like this and to see it just in these political and politicized terms. Now, the commentary session is actually just an instrument for politics. And, we could even look at the micropolitics of this hadith commentary session and say, for instance, that the commentator was competing for his own prestige and reputation within the scholarly scene in Damascus. But if we just analyze it from that perspective, and I really think that kind of analysis is important to do, but if we limited ourselves in that way, we would miss out on what made the hadith worth commenting on in the first place and what was intellectually at stake for all of the students who had come from as far away as Indonesia and Central Asia to hear this commentator explain Bukhari. So in that respect, what I tried to do in treating this tradition was not simply to reduce it to competition over social capital or prestige or honor or material rewards or political goals, but also to think about what was intellectually at stake. What does it mean to craft an excellent interpretation of a particular hadith? What are the kinds of benefits, the religious benefits that are at stake when interpreting a hadith? And to try to tell the story in a kind of stereoscopic, with a kind of stereoscopic vision, thinking about both the material rewards, the social rewards that are at stake, but also what I call, the interpretive aims or the intellectual aims of the tradition.
And another major strength of this book, Joel, is the way in which you connect these micro narratives and stories to do with individual scholars and their journeys with larger questions that are central to this project. I was wondering, could you share with our listeners what was the Baji affair, which had to do with the scholar Abul Walid al-Baji from the 11th century? And how does the Baji affair in some ways bring to view these larger intellectual and material stakes that you've been talking about in relation to Hadith commentary?
Great. Yeah. So, this is one of the earliest accounts of a live Hadith commentary session that we have in the 11th century Andalusia, in a little port city called Denia, in the Western Mediterranean. What Baji had done, he had gone to Mecca and he had studied with some of these great Hadith scholars from Central Asia, and he returned to Andalusia to transmit all of these hadith texts, including Sahih al-Bukhari, and he would have these commentary sessions where he explained the meaning of the hadith. And there was a hadith that suggested that Muhammad, this was the hadith at Hudaybiyah, where the early believers and their opponents hammered out a treaty. And the question was whether or not Muhammad should sign his name Muhammad the Prophet, or whether he should sign his name Muhammad, the son of his father. And in that hadith, there's a phrase that says that Muhammad got so, he was so frustrated by this, what seemed like this endless arguing, that he got so frustrated, he took the document and he wrote Muhammad, son of Abdullah. And this, apparently in one of the accounts of this hadith commentary session that Baji was explaining, this hadith, a student asked, did Muhammad write by hand or not? And Baji said, of course, do you not see it written in the hadith? Muhammad took the document and he wrote his name, Muhammad, son of Abdullah. So the reason that this was such a sticking point was that it really undermined the orthodoxy of this doctrine of Muhammad, the unlettered prophet, this Nabi Ummi, as someone whose sincerity, and in a way that the sincerity of the Quran itself, or the authenticity of the Quran itself, was guaranteed by the fact that Muhammad hadn't read or hadn't been able to read any other text. So that's the proof that he heard the Quran directly from God. So if he could write, then maybe he was literate. And so this whole debate really spun out into a much larger affair. Apparently there were protests in the streets, and there were popular preachers who were condemning Baji for giving this interpretation of a hadith. And it got to the ear of the Emir of Dania, who actually had to send out letters asking for clarification on this issue. And ultimately, Baji ended up writing a volume defending his interpretation of this hadith, where he was able to claim, yes, Muhammad was unlettered at the time that he received the Quran, but he also wrote in this particular instance, that those two things could be possible at the same time, that both of those two things could be true at the same time. And people could disagree with him where they could agree with him, but that seemed to quell the loudest voices. But I think what that shows is that these hadith commentaries and the interpretation of hadith is not just a derivative or marginal or solitary practice, that hadith are interpreted socially in a community and for a community, and that there was a lot politically at stake for Baji, I mean, his own social survival. And I think there were some who were even calling that he be executed, or that this was a capital offense, that he had interpreted the hadith in this way. But on the other hand, there was a lot intellectually riding on the interpretation of this hadith. So so again, I really hope that drives home this point that as historians looking at this kind of material, if we just think about it in the abstract, what the intellectual debate was, or if we just look at the politics of the situation, we're missing out on an important piece of the puzzle. So I try to tell the story of this affair attending to both the intellectual stakes, but also the political stakes.
In the next few chapters, Joel, you conduct some very interesting analyses of these rivalries between different Hadith commentators. And what you show really is the way in which this scholarly elite was also in conversation with, or you know, was under the sponsorship of the political elite of different moments in history. And you recount some very interesting debates, such as debates and rivalries happening in the Sultan's garden, for example, and this fascinating episode that you narrate about this rivalry between Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani and Badr al-Din al-Aini on the whole question of plagiarism and attribution, etc. So what made you focus on this question of rivalries? How is that connected to the larger argument that you try to make? And perhaps you could tell our listeners a bit about this rivalry, or this controversy that unfolded between Ibn Hajar and al-Aini.
So in a way, this was the golden era of Hadith commentary, the age of Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani and Badr al-Din al-Aini. They were both composing commentaries on Sahih Bukhari at the same time in different corners of Cairo. And apparently their students would go back and forth between their dictation sessions, and they would share notes with, apparently one student who had attended Ibn Hajar's dictation session went to Aini and shared the notes that he had learned from Ibn Hajar. And the reason why the rivalry is so important is because a lot of Mamluk social history has been interested in analyzing the way in which the ulama, the individual actors or households amongst the ulama, were competing for social capital and prestige and reputation and judicial appointments and generous stipends and gifts and so on. And so there's been a lot already written to think about, to help us think about competition amongst scholars and to try to explain the activity of scholars as competition for the Sultan's favor or for an appointment or honor, prestige, and so on. So what I wanted to look at was, again, not to diminish the important social and material stakes of these rivalries, but also to think seriously about what intellectually was at stake for these scholars. And we see for Ibn Hajar how the integrity of the commentary tradition was at stake. I mean, when you borrow without attribution, you may you may end up quoting something that's baseless or introducing something into the tradition that has a weak source or a weak provenance. And so he was very it wasn't just that he was competing with Aini for students and for appointments. He was also really intellectually invested in the arguments about how to interpret Hadith.
Let's shift the focus a bit, Joel, in talking about your discussion of Suyuti's engagement with Hadith commentary. And thus far, you know, the commentators that you've been talking about adopted what you call a more encyclopedic approach to Hadith commentaries. But with Suyuti, you offer a very different kind of a paradigm, a counter paradigm, as you call it, in your book, with the practice of concision rather than an encyclopedic approach. Could you tell us a bit about this practice of concision and how, or what sort of a counter paradigm does it provide us in Hadith commentaries?
Sure. So if we just study these great commentaries of Ibn Hajar and Aini, and these were multi-volume works that took 30 or more than 30 years to complete, we might come away thinking that all commentaries were these rich and encyclopedic texts. And one of the things that you notice in studying this tradition is that actually sometimes those texts are the exception rather than the rule. and that a lot of the texts that were popular amongst readers were actually short summaries or short abridgments that could very concisely sum up the tradition for a general audience. And Suyuti was one of those scholars who I think really tried to perfect the art of concision. He did write a very long commentary on Malik's Muwatta, which I think gave him some credibility and some credentials. But he was the first to try to comment on every single one of the canonical collections of Hadith. And he would write these concise commentaries, and that was what he aimed for. He wanted them to be useful. He thought that these multi-volume commentaries that commented on every single word or phrase were overdoing it. They were useless. They couldn't engage the public and were of little benefit for that reason. So that was what he tried to do in his commentary, and I try to walk the reader through the ways in which he sometimes succeeded and sometimes failed, because there are certain hadiths that require longer interpretation than can be delivered in just a few lines, and you see the way in which he tries and sometimes fails to capture the meaning of a hadith in a concise way.
Let's move to South Asia and your discussion of the hadith commentary tradition in early modern and modern South Asia. And what you really show very convincingly in that section of your book is that hadith commentary among scholars from different ideological and normative orientations really becomes a medium through which they negotiate and mediate the tentacles of colonial power and the new conditions of colonial modernity. Could you speak a bit about, and you primarily focus on the works of the scholars from the Deoband school and the Ahle Hadith movement in late 19th century India. Could you speak a bit about how scholars from these two movements engage with Hadith commentaries precisely to restore or assemble their authority in these new conditions of colonial modernity? And the fascinating example that you give here and also earlier in your book is that of the discretionary punishment, the Ta'zir punishment. So could you speak a bit about this aspect of your argument in relation to the South Asian context?
Oh, sure. So this, again, I mean, this is the Hadith commentary tradition. It wasn't just arbitrary that I took up India. The tradition of Hadith commentary in India was very rich. Following the Mamluk period, there was even a Gujarati sultan who attempted to analyze Hadith according to certain chronicles. So these scholars amongst the Deoband and the Ahle Hadith really saw their role as emulating their Mamluk era predecessors. And we see the revival of long dictation and commentary sessions in schools and in madrasas in India, and also the printing of these multi-volume hadith commentary works that are then circulated back into the Middle East. And again, it would be easy to look at the proliferation of these commentaries and say, well, it was merely an instrument in which to challenge the colonial predicament, or to challenge this the consequences of colonialism. And of course, you do see that. I mean, in the text, actually, there are explicit mentions of British officials, and there are these great anecdotes that discuss all of the new modern technologies that arise in this period. While scholars are commenting on these hadith, they're talking about these kinds of issues. And yet, they also really cared about the integrity of the Islamic legal tradition, And as you pointed out, this case that I look at, the case of ta'zir, or discretionary punishment, was not just one that Muslim scholars cared about, but also British jurists. There was, in fact, a British jurist who, you know, I think in one of his polemics against Islamic law in India, he says, so the British public, they're always so surprised to hear about the stonings and the amputations for the hands and those kinds of things. But what's really problematic about Islamic law is the amount of discretion that Muslim jurists have in meting out ta'zir, these kinds of ta'zir punishments. And part of the reason, of course, is that the British really prized certainty and predictability, regardless of local or regional context. And in a way, what you see, I mean, this one of the scholars that I look closely at, Anbar Shah al-Kashmiri, when he is dealing with these hadith that would seem to suggest that discretionary punishment ought to be limited to 10 strokes or 10 lashings and no more, he actually reads against the apparent meaning of that hadith and says, no, actually, Muslim judges have as much discretion as they want. So in that case, he's actually siding with the Hanafi legal school over the what would seem to be the apparent meaning of the hadith. And yet, in the end, you also see that he's also worried about what lesson the general public might take away from that position, that they think that they could, if a person thinks that they can take the law into their own hand, that would also be deeply problematic. So he says, judges have wide discretion. But it has to be a qualified judge. It can't be just any Muslim. Any Muslim's discretion. So you really do see the way in which these hadith commentaries really take on a new meaning in a radically different political context, and the way in which scholars are thinking about what's the meaning of these hadith with legal consequences in an era where Muslims are further removed from power than they had been in the past.
Rajul, you title the epilogue to this book, Islamism, ISIS, and the Politics of Interpretation. Could you share with us a bit about what you try to do in this epilogue?
Well, I think that, of course, it will inevitably date the book to talk about the Islamic State in Iraq and Sham. But I think that was part of the point that I was trying to make, which is that we all come to this tradition from a different from our different moment in time, our own political and social contexts. And for me, it was important to think about the ways in which hadith commentary was not just something from the Muslim historical past, but was something that was being defined and redefined in our present. So the idea was to, many observers who were looking at the Islamic State's propaganda would often talk about the way in which they interpreted the Quran or the way in which they would talk about theology. But what I noticed was actually, this was in part because of their own genealogy as a Salafi group,
that they were very interested in hadith and interpreting hadith. And I noticed that these commentaries that I had studied, Ibn Hajar's Fath al-Bari, for instance, and Nawawi's commentaries on hadith, and Ibn Rajab al-Hanbali's commentaries on hadith, these were Mamlukiya commentaries, were being cited in the Islamic State's propaganda. So I wanted to think about the ways in which the Islamic tradition, the classical Islamic tradition of hadith commentary was being being repurposed by these kinds of groups, and to think a little bit about what that might teach us about the current state of the ways in which these our technologies and our current politics have been reshaping this commentary tradition in the present. And you learn, for instance, just how modern and hermeneutically flexible the Islamic State propagandists are. In many ways, they are represent a radical break from the Hadith commentary tradition. For instance, they don't use their own names when they're giving opinions, which is very unusual. And they speak very explicitly about the present and how the politics of the present influence the interpretation of the Hadith, whereas works, prior works would often try to speak to a kind of timelessness, so that the Hadith could be so that their Hadith commentaries could be read across time. So you know, for me, I was really trying to critically engage these kinds of texts and trying to put them in the context of this longer history of Hadith commentary.
So Joel, as we're coming to the end of our time here, could you tell us a bit about what might be the next project that you're thinking of doing?
So I have a new project that I've been working on, and I'm calling it Prophet and Prophecy, P-R-O-F-I-T and P-R-O-P-H-E-C-Y. And the idea is to think, it's in a way, it's kind of a sequel to this book, in the sense that I'm interested in the way the Islamic interpretive tradition is intertwined with its social, economic, and political context. But I'm looking at the way in which issues of trade and commerce were debated within this tradition, but resituating it in the context of the spice trade. And the inspiration there was just the fact that so many of the Hadith commentators I studied, like Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, were actually traders. They were major wholesale traders. And so at the same time that they were delivering fatwas on whether or not a certain customs tax on trade by sea was lawful or unlawful, they were also heavily invested in the spice trade. So I really wanted to think about that intersection between the intellectual tradition and the economic and political context.
Said the Prophet of God, Hadith Commentary Across the Millennium, published by the University of California Press and written, of course, by Professor Joel Blecher. Joel, thank you so much for your time today. It was lovely talking to you. finally. And thank you for providing us with such a fantastic book to wrestle with and to learn from. So really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
So this was my conversation with Professor Joel Blecher about his wonderful new book, Said the Prophet of God. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please also join us next time for another fresh episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.